I was having one of those moments where I was like, oh my God, I've got free time. What the hell am I supposed to do with it? And then I realize you do not have free time. Need to get my butt up here and do this podcast. So without further ado, understanding ancient humans' connection to nature, what we lost in body communication. Ancient humans likely had a profound connection with nature, enabling them to interpret animal vocals and behaviors in ways that modern humans often cannot. This understanding was essential for survival, aiding in activities like hunting and predatory avoidance, as seen in archaeological findings from sites like Olvidai Gorge in Tanzania, The Guardian. Their auditory adaptations, such as enhanced mid-range hearing between 1,000 and 300 hertz, or 3,000 hertz, excuse me, suggest that they were equipped to detect and interpret animal sounds, which was crucial in open habitats. Beyond practicality, this connection influenced their culture, with many myths and legends depicting animals as communicative beings. For example, ancient texts like Aliens on the Nature of Animals describe fish helping each other and dolphins cooperating with humans, reflecting an awareness of animal intelligence and social behaviors. While modern humans retain some ability to process animal vocalizations, our urbanized lifestyles have likely diminished this intuitive link, highlighting a significant difference in how we interact with the natural world compared to our ancestors. Scientific studies support that humans share neural mechanisms with non-human primates for identifying individuals through vocalization, suggesting an evolutionary basis for understanding animal communications. Additionally, research on vocal learning in animals and humans shows similarities in how we and certain animals, like songbirds, process and mimic sound, which may have been more pronounced in ancient times. I'm pretty much going to cut it off there because the point of this whole thing is how much we have lost in dealing with nature. I sit there, I've got crows, and anyone who knows anything about crows, they're a mated pair. They find their mate and they're together until the other one dies. So I got these two crows and I was like, oh, I've got this turkey carcass that I cooked up. I don't really want to throw it away. But it's too much for my chickens to devour. By the way, I do not feed my chickens chicken. I think that's kind of weird. But anyways, but I had this turkey. So I gave the chickens, like, you know, some of the stuff because it was a lot. And then the turkey carcass, I put in a giant silver bowl and put it by what we have as a small shed. And these crows, it was funny because I guess they thought I set a trap. He kept testing the bowl. He pecked at it. He'd jump away. The other one's in the tree calling every time, like, oh God, is she going to get you? Oh, the boogeyman. And they're so smart. They're watching me through this giant French door that we have. And every time he saw me by the window, they all flew away. I was like, oh, okay. So we had to step further into the house and watch away from the window where they really couldn't see our shadows. And he kept testing that bowl until he decided that, oh, okay, it's safe. I can eat it. And they ate the turkey, blah, 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 blah. But anyways, come to find out, it was like days later, all of a sudden, there's a raccoon. And I know that the crow talks to the raccoon. It's weird, I know. But I know he talks to that raccoon. So anyways, I guess the crows got done with the turkey and they shared the information with the raccoon. By the way, I got cameras, so I know the raccoon had no idea about this turkey. And he comes along and he grabs what the crow decided he couldn't eat, which is basically just bones. I was like, what a bastard. Didn't even give him any juicy parts. But anyways, that's that part of the story. Well, it's planting time, so I've got corn that's been set in water, soaking so that when I put it in the ground, it sprouts easier. It's a giant bowl of corn. I go out to the field with this bowl, driving out there on my quad, and apparently this crow has followed me from the house to the field. And I put the bowl down because I had left the tiller to make me a line to put it in. And I left with the quad, but I left the bowl. I turn around, I get back to the garden shed, I turn around, and here's this crow, just as happy as dandy. He's a hopping flight towards my bowl of corn. And I caw at him like a nasty caw, like, caw, because he did it to me when we first got here. He looked at me like, oh, it's off limits, and flew away. Like he understood. Oh, okay. The turkey I can have, the corn I cannot. And he left. Didn't bother the bowl at all because I wasn't done. It wasn't like I ran back over there after I cawed at him. I was like, all these ancient stories that come out of animals talking or spirit animals or, you know, things of that nature just makes you wonder. He wasn't a bird man. He was a bird that apparently understood humans, and humans understood the bird because it was better at communicating. It's just thoughts. Next story. High IQ Africans rise to prominence while high IQ Europeans fade into the background. The idea that individuals above average IQs in Africa measured through pattern recognition tests like Raven's progressive matrices ascended to positions of great power and influence akin to kings, while those with similar cognitive abilities in Europe and other regions languish in relative obscurity, rest on premise that intelligence yields vastly different outcomes based on regional context. This article explores why high IQ, defined as exceptional pattern recognition, leads to extraordinary prominence in Africa, but only modest achievement in Europe. Using pre-2010 data to ground the analysis in cognitive metrics and avoiding terms that soften the stark contrast in outcomes. Raven's progressive matrices test the ability to discern patterns and solve abstract problems with a global average IQ of 100. Pre-2010 studies such as Lennon Van Haven 2002 estimate a sub-Sahara African IQs at 70 to 82, though critics like Wickchurch's 2007 argue for 80 to 85, citing test biases. Europe's average is 96 to 100. High IQ individuals above 115, about 16%, excel in pattern recognition, a skill critical for strategic thinking and leadership. The hypothesis persists that in Africa, where high IQ is rare, these individuals dominate, while in Europe, where high IQ is more common, they achieve less distinction. In Africa, an exceptional pattern recognition translates into unparalleled influence due to scarcity of high IQ individuals. If the regional average is 80, an IQ of 115, standard deviations above the mean occurring, blah, 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 population basically is higher, this rarity amplifies impact. Historical leaders like Mansa Musa of Mali Empire, 14th century, demonstrates strategic brilliance in trade and governance, suggestive of high pattern recognition and consolidating wealth and power. No IQ test existed, but their success implies cognitive elite status. Modern examples reinforce this. That 2006 Nigerian study found top university students scored 100 to 105 on Ravens, with outliers at 120 plus. These high scores often rise to elite roles, business tycoons, political leaders, leveraging pattern recognition to navigate complex social and economic landscapes. For instance, Aliko Dangote, Africa's richest man pre-2010, built a cement empire through strategic foresight, a hallmark of high IQ in societies where cognitive elites stand out sharply. High IQ individuals exploit opportunities to achieve king-like status, dominating industries or politics. Cultural factors amplify this. African leadership often rewards decisive, strategic thinkers. A high IQ individual in a village or an urban center solving problems like resource allocation gains outsized influence. The scarcity of competitors ensures their prominence, unlike in Europe's crowded cognitive landscape. In Europe, with an IQ average of 98 to 100, high IQ individuals are more common. The abundance diminishes their distinctiveness, historical figures like Isaac Newton. achieved greatness, but pre-2010 data suggests most high IQ Europeans don't reach such heights. In 2001 UK study of Mensa members found many in mid-level roles, engineers, teachers, not transformative leaders. Pattern recognition, while valuable, compete in saturated environment. Europe's structured systems, university corporations channel high IQ talent into specialized roles, diluting its impact. A 2005 German study showed that high IQ individuals often become academics or technicians, not kings. Unlike Africa, where high IQ can singularly propel someone to dominance, Europe's mediocre but competitive landscape dispersed cognitive talent across fields, yielding solid but unremarkable outcomes. For example, a high IQ software developer in London contributes incrementally, overshadowed by peers with similar abilities. Cultural expectations also play a role. A 2004 study of European leadership noted emphasis on collaboration over individual brilliance. Unlike Africa's valorization of standout strategists, high IQ Europeans thus blend into the system their pattern recognition skills, producing steady but not extraordinary results. High IQ individuals in Africa excelling in pattern recognition achieve extraordinary prominence due to their rarity, becoming kings in business, politics, or society. In Europe, the same cognitive ability yields modest outcomes as high IQ individuals are common and compete in saturated systems. Pre-2010 data underscores this divide. Africa's cognitive elites stand out, while Europe's blend in. The stark contrast in outcomes reflects not just intelligence, but the power of scarcity versus the abundance in shaping who rises and who fades. Oh, well. So Kash Patel comes out again that they are going to release these Epstein files. All of it. All of it's going to be released. I may actually do a video on that if I have time. Because I just like, you've got to be kidding me. Why are we doubling down on the lie? Because how many times are they going to tell you they're going to release that list and then nothing comes out from it? Because at this point, I mean, really, what is a list? What's the Epstein list? Is it a list of everybody that he's let borrow his plane? Is it a list of people that have visited the island? Because you could start releasing the list now. Oh, we've gotten through page 1 through 5 and have cleared everyone that's not a minor. Oh, good. Now we've gotten through pages 5 through 10 and we've cleared everyone who's not a victim and a minor. Oh, that's good. There's no reason why they don't give it out now. It's just a stall technique. We're going over it. Okay.